Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest, of course, wonderful, Sean Ryan, who is, are you an actor also, or are you, do you define as pure cabaret singer?
No, that's what's great. I started as an actor when I was 6 years old.
Oh, and I've been in Arizona. What'd
and,
you do?
Oliver. A musical.
Oh,
Oliver.
So on stage.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Stage work. And then went to college for acting in New York and came back to San Francisco, where we had moved when I was about 10.
Uh-huh.
So came back to San Francisco, did professional theater, and was called down to L.A. for so many auditions that I finally just moved to L.A.
Can I ask you what the process of that is? Just curious, because you don't just get born and then go to auditions.
Right. Yeah.
That's, how did that, like, what's the short version gradual of that? I'm always curious.
God, the short version is you work really hard.
But was this something you wanted to do when you said to your mother, I want to be on the stage, take me to auditions, or what?
Yes. I think I saw kids acting on TV.
Oh, okay.
Actually, back in our day, it was a TV show called Who's the Boss with...
oh, of course.
Yeah.
Milano.
Uh-huh, yeah, Alyssa Milano and Danny Pintaro.
Right.
And years later, maybe when I was 30, I became friendly with Danny Pintaro, and now he's one of my greatest friends. But that was probably one of the weirdest things that's ever happened, because I thought, you were the kid that I used to watch.
I know, it's
that
very...
That made me want to be an actor.
It gets muddled when you look at fiction and real life, when fiction is so visible, and you're so drawn into it.
Yes, especially when it's the fiction that you've created. So that's even weirder, when you think, you know, you have all these daydreams, and people tell you your whole life that they are just daydreams, and then when they start to come true, you're like...
Let you think that you couldn't have these?
Oh, sure. I think there's a good sense
Shame
of,
on
I
them.
Know, I know. And there's two sides to the coin. There are people that will try to, through a sense of responsibility, give you a sense of your own mortality in show business. So they want to make sure that you understand where you're fitting, at least to start. You know, we always like to say that Meryl Streep can do anything. And that she started that way. Well, she didn't. She started as an ingenue. And she was an ingenue for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But what she did was she took that ingenue.
Oh, and shaded it.
Did so many things with it that people thought, wait, maybe she's not just an ingenue. And then slowly, piece by piece, things came out. And then she is who she is today.
So people try. People will tell children, you know, this is really hard. You probably won't be able to do it. And that's just terrible.
It's horrible. I think it's like...
I heard somebody the other day, I think his name is Sean... Oh, I'm not going to get it. But anyway, he's a motivational speaker.
Mm.
And he started out this one talk with, don't accept any prediction that does not empower you.
I like that.
Who wouldn't like that? Of course, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, it's interesting because in a way it can be a motivation. It was certainly a motivation for me to work harder. But I think for some kids, unfortunately, you know, especially young artists, which I work a lot with, it can be very... you know, halting in, in their creative growth. I think it's the example we give all the time is that we draw, you know, as kids, we draw for 5-6 years, we illustrate. And the very first time we draw a chicken and someone says, oh, that's a great cow, a little piece of our artistic sense dies. And then just slowly our artistic sense just leaves us. And we
Because
think,
what you should be saying is, that's wonderful. Tell me about it.
Yeah. What is that? What were you thinking about? What did you feel when you did that? How do you feel about it? What's your self-evaluation on it? Because as artists, we really need to be able, especially as performing artists, we need to be able to leave the stage with a sense of, did it, got it, there it is. As opposed to, did you like it? How was I?
Oh.
What did you think? There's so, you know, and not to say that you shouldn't be humble and listen to the audience as well, but you know, as a performer, you know, and so I try to teach the kids that I work with at our camp, I try to teach them that, that when they leave the stage, they just need to ask three questions. What worked, what didn't, and why?
That doesn't make you not humble.
It's a big rock, sorry.
That doesn't make you not humble.
No, it makes you a good self-evaluator. And I think that that's the way life is, too. If you walk away from something, especially like a conflict, you know, it's so easy for us as humans to say, oh, well, she was obviously in a bad space today, and that's why we had a fight, and I'm not going to be friends with her anymore. Well... Is that everything, or was there something also that wasn't
working? Were
you
present in the room as well?
Was it? Did you have a fight with someone the night before, and that, you know, parlayed over into the lunch today with a friend that didn't work out?
Sure. Reading people is a tricky business.
Mm.
And also there's kind of a narcissism when you put yourself in the equation.
Right.
You know, she's, yes.
So we continue to teach,
What's the camp? What's the camp that you...
So in May, we're celebrating 15 years of this camp. And it's the Young Actors Theater Camp. My husband and I started it, like I said, 15 years ago. And it started as 25 kids in a room. And now we have 1,000 campers a year. So we run...
Where is this?
Well, we have a couple locations. We've got Sonoma, Santa Cruz, and Sacramento. And they're overnight camps. And at first, we had kids from the Bay. And now it's
so
about...
So you mean like they come for a week or two?
A week or two weeks, overnight camp. Some kids come all summer. Uh-huh. Some kids come for 7 weeks. And they, you know, they don't just study musical theater. They study all the areas of the performing arts. Because when I started out in, I was an assistant in an overnight camp, or in a day camp when I came back from college, just as like a fun side job for a summer. And, you know, we did Sound of Music, which was great for Maria, but every other kid in the camp had to pick between a Nazi or a nun. And I thought, are they having fun? This seems so dull to me that all they're doing is singing one song and waiting in the wings for act two so they can come take their bow. So what we did was we developed a program taught all by professionals. So we're taking, like, this summer, we're taking songwriting from Kristen and Robert Lopez, who won the Academy Award for Frozen. Like, literally, you're learning how to write a song from the people who wrote Let It Go. And that's just one class out of 100 that kids get to take. And the adults, what I think is really funny is when the adults aren't teaching a class, we're taking a class.
Sure, because you could always keep learning from these people you're bringing.
These are amazing performers. And, you know, we're honoring Darren Criss at our big gala this May, our 15-year gala. And he was probably one of the very first famous teachers that came to the camp. And we owe everything to him, because then every star of Glee, every star of Broadway started to see, what is this camp? And it was so funny, after about 3 years of really good, famous working professionals coming in, who really had something to share with the kids. You know, it's not just that they're famous, but of course it's fun to learn from someone you recognize from TV or film. We actually got a phone call from one of the kids from Glee, from his agent. And he said, how come Harry hasn't been invited to camp yet? And I said, I'm sorry, what? And he said, we haven't gotten an invitation, and almost everyone on Glee has gotten an invitation. And I said, Harry can come to camp anytime he wants.
Oh, isn't that funny how sensitive people are, though?
Well, you think we're all just... Yes. We all want to be invited to the party.
Yes.
And so we said, send him. So we came that summer and taught a dance class, and it was super fun. But so that's
I have a little question. I mean, it's kind of an observation. I probably shouldn't waste your time with it. But you referred to, and when you became 30, and then 15 years ago when you did this, you look like you're about 24.
You are very nice.
So that's a little confusing. So I'm glad you're saying all this, because people who look at you wouldn't.
Yes, in Hollywood, I still only play like 26 to 32, which is very nice. Uh-huh. I'm actually 38, and I don't mind still playing younger. Yeah. I feel like, you know, a 92-year-old Elaine Stritch on the inside, like with a martini and a cigarette, just being like, yep, another day at the office. But yeah, it's been that's been an interesting part to show business too. And it helps me because every character I've ever played is younger than me. Mm-hmm. So hopefully...
Oh, so you've been there and you can understand.
Hopefully I have the life experience to understand it. And hopefully I'm not judging the character. Especially when I was in when I was in my mid-20s, I got called in a lot to play college-aged guys. And the dialogue that they write for college-aged guys is not the best dialogue. It's very, you know, it's to move the storyline. It's to tease the girl, or, you know, to have a bro. So it became very like, oh, God, do I have to keep doing this? And that's really when the transition started for me in show business, because I had worked in L.A. for 2 or 3 years on TV and had a lot of guest stars and a lot of fun spots. And it was very exciting to have people say the next day, I saw you on TV last night.
And so what were the shows that you did that you
I did Bones and The Mentalist.
I love Bones.
I loved Bones too. And that was actually a great role. Very fun. But I
what was your role on that?
I played a character called Destiny Childs, which, yes, I was a drag queen in one scene. And then I was the suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So then I came back later and talked about being bullied and abused as a kid. And it was actually a really nice scene.
Mm.
But so I did a lot of fun, you know, guest spots like that. And while I love it, and while I love the money, please never stop giving me these jobs, Warner Brothers and Fox and anyone else listening. I love these jobs. There wasn't as much creative fulfillment as I was getting from independent film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually in an acting class. I was moderating an acting class at our camp, just kind of watching one of the teachers. And she said to the class, if there's a role that you haven't gotten to play yet, write it.
Oh.
And I thought, you know, I do write. I mean, I've written my cabaret shows for years. I've written jokes for years. I've written shows for other people. Why not try? So I go from that class literally to my office, and I write this script that then became Charlie, which is the film that we had at the Cannes Film Festival last year that sold to Breaking Glass Pictures and just was released in December. And I got a lot of notes for that. And I thought, you know what, this is pretty interesting. When you look at the creative types, you know, like my favorite examples are like George Clooney or Jennifer Aniston. These are people that should have been pigeonholed. They're people that should have been set in this box that they designed for themselves. You know, George Clooney played the cute guy, the doctor on ER. It should have ended there for him, technically, in show business rules. But what did he do? He went out and found producing partners. He went out and found amazing writers and amazing scripts and got Academy Award nominations and became a producer himself. Same thing with Jennifer Aniston.
So you're kind of saying you live a different life when you stay at the whim of those who are hiring and typing you than you do if you set your own definitions.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And I don't know that a young person going into Hollywood, you know, I don't think that everyone knows that. I think a lot of times people just think, oh gosh, I'd be so lucky to have one line on one TV show. Once you get there, it's awesome. Again, the money's awesome. I loved it. But it's just not as creatively fulfilling as looking at the whole picture and saying, what kind of art do I want to continue to put out there? So that's actually how Andrea and I first worked together, was she played my stepmother, my evil mother.
Who did?
Andrea Markovici.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's how you got
to. I mean, we've been known each other for years, but it was our first working job. She plays my mother in the film Charlie, and she is amazingly haunting. I mean, people don't even believe it's her because she's such a great actress.
Well, that'll go right on my list.
Oh, okay. People remember her. I mean, certainly her acting roles. She had a Golden Globe nomination. I mean, she's genius. But so we did that project, and while we were working on that, we started talking about a feature that I was writing. And she wrote me earlier this year and said, when's the feature? Because I'd really like to work with you again. And I said, you know what? I have the Great American Music Hall. And they've asked me to book an opener. And I said, and I would never ask Andrea Markovici, the queen of cabaret,
tricky,
to be an opener.
Right.
I said, what do you think about co-billing? What do you think if we each do an act?
Yes.
And she said, I love it. Let's do it.
Can we step back a minute?
Yes, please, please,
you've
please.
Gone from one thing to now.
Oh,
that
that's just my life, yeah.
Well, sure, I understand that. It is probably most lives, but I'm just gonna
please,
give you a turn left.
Please keep me on track.
And that is, you've gone from this whole other wonderful rendition of life to how you're performing with Andrea Markovici as in a cabaret setting. When did you start doing cabaret?
I moved back in 1998.
I hear you're wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I have a lot of fun. But I moved back here in 1998 to San Francisco and did a professional theater production that had come up from LA. And the tour contract was for 9 months. After 3 months, ticket sales were fine, but they had to close the show. There wasn't enough ticket sales to keep the show going. But I was paid for 9 months by Equity. So I took some time off. And in that, there was a club here on Market Street called Pioff's Cabaret. This wonderful man named Dan ran it, and he had a cabaret contest.
So you called him? Or you knew about the contest?
I said to my friends, what is cabaret? Like, I sort of know what it is, but what is it? And so they said, well, it's basically musical theater songs of your choosing without a script. And that was the very basic that I learned. And then I started going to see people like Andrea Markovici and Karen Akers and Karen Mason and all these wonderful performers, Bobby Short, trying to see what they were doing. And what they were doing was telling the Great American Songbook's story through song.
Because they're definitely, I mean, I've noticed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that the relationship of a cabaret performer to the audience is very different than anything else.
It is.
There's really kind of a flirtatious connection.
There has to be.
What is that about?
Well, for me, it's not so much cabaret anymore. Mine kind of transitioned into more of like a Rat Pack feel. So I work with a full band. I have backup singers. Technically, my band is sort of a jazz and country band.
Mm-hmm.
But yet then you put...
They travel with you?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Then you put this cabaret singer in front of them who decides to do, you know, all about that bass, but in a jazz rendition. And it's very... All I can really say is it's entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
If you came into my living room, it's the exact same thing you'd see if we had a party, a cocktail party at my house, We'd have someone at the piano, and over the course of the night, 10 singers would get up and entertain your pants off. It has nothing to do with the era the song was written, the way in which you present it, how you tell the story. It's only if you entertain. If people in the audience are going, I've never seen anything like this. This is so much fun. Like, why don't more people do this? And that's really that.
So you're not giving a message. How restful.
I don't think so. Yeah. I think maybe my second line in my show is, to give it away, but it's funny. We start, after the opening number, we start with Send in the Clowns. Mm-hmm. And it's very ballad. And mm-hmm. I get about the second line in, and then I stop the band and go, we're not going to do that to you. And the audience almost breathes a sigh of relief. Yeah. Because they think like, oh no, is he going to take us on a musical journey? Not a musical journey. I don't want to go on a musical journey. I just want to sit and enjoy my cocktail with some good music, songs that a fun person has picked out. And then, of course, I have a lot of comedy and, there's a lot of that mixed in. So that's cabaret to me, in my definition, is really just entertainment. It's like as if you were in someone's living room and they speak right to you and come sit on your lap if they want to.
Well,
you
know what I'm saying? That kind of intimate relationship with the audience.
Very intimate. Yeah. You
can tell they're talking to you.
Mm-hmm. And communicating a story that is very personal. So when you see a lot of pop music, these are songs that are written for the radio. You know, you can go see a singer whose entire album is melancholy, sad pop music. And that person may be in the best point in their lives. I mean, of course they are. They're on tour with a huge hit album. Mm-hmm. But they're still singing this melancholy, sad album. The greatest thing about what we do as cabaret artists is you get to do what you feel.
Yeah.
So if I go to a ballad, I only have two ballads in my show. And they're meaningful, not sappy. But if I go to a ballad and the audience is still laughing from the joke before, I don't try to force the audience to come along. I don't try to change that energy. I usually take the sheet music and rip it up and say, let's move on. We're not doing the ballad because they're not in the place for it. And we've gotten them to this place. Mm-hmm. So let's stop manipulating them and let's just have fun. So that's really what we do.
It does sound wonderful. What else is, what else is on your doc for coming up is kind of silly. Just tell me about the rest of life. What's personal life like?
I'm celebrating. My husband and I are celebrating our 15 year together.
See, another one of those big clumps when you only look 26. Okay, mm-hmm. Well,
I was 11. I was no. And then we have our 10 year wedding anniversary on May the 13th, and we're going to be celebrating at the Cannes Film Festival because the second film that I wrote and directed called Randy is going to be in competition at the American Pavilion.
Now, what does he do?
My husband is a producer and an actor as well.
Oh, so you're both in the same.
Yeah, which actually some people thought originally is weird because we're two guys around the same age. Do you compete for the same roles? Never, 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 never.
But you're both appropriate for the same roles?
No, not usually.
No.
He's pretty much put it bluntly, he's the gay guy that seems straight. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks he would just be a straight guy. I mean, he's very handsome, very dashing. I have to beat the women off of him with a stick. But he executive produces. He just did his first feature. And then, of course, he produced Randy, which we're going to Cannes with. And it actually premieres April 10th at the Palm Beach Film Festival. Mm-hmm. So we do the Great American Music Hall on Saturday, April 9th. And the very next morning, we fly to Florida.
So do you know Hunter Hughes?
Yes.
Must, of course.
Yeah.
Because he's there now, isn't he?
Yes.
With mm-hmm. Guys reading. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So we're just touring with this new film. And then, of course, the summer brings summer camp. And we spend all summer. People say to me all the time, how do you do that? How do you spend all that time with, 700 kids all summer long?
It is 700. And
well, it's 150 at a time. 150 to 170 at a time.
But you say you have three different locations.
Mm-hmm. So there's
all running simultaneously.
We go with them. Uh-huh. We go with them like a little circus. So we start in Sonoma.
What's the name of it?
It's called the Young Actors Theater Camp.
Okay.
Yeah, the kids call it YATC for short, YATC. But it's
you start in Sonoma. Where in Sonoma?
In the town of Casadero. So just northwest of Guerneville, just of the Russian River, which makes our days off very nice because we're right there in wine country.
Really? Yeah.
So I say, I will see you all in 36 hours. Yeah. I am going to have some Chardonnay and a pool. But it's just such a fun way to spend the summer. And then we go right back into production.
You look like your whole life is a fun way to spend.
I like every moment. I have not woken up in the last 15 years of doing this, of doing the camp, of being a professional actor, being married to a fabulous man. I don't wake up and say, oh, today.
Did you ever?
Yes.
Oh, really? When was it? May I ask when that?
When I was telling you about the professional theater show that I did here in San Francisco, I had quit my waiting tables job. And I'm going to be an actor, and this is 9 months, and I won the cabaret competition that we were talking about, and everything was looking great. And then the money ran out, like it probably does for a lot of artists. And I had to go back to bartending. And I'll tell you what, I did it for about another year, and I think it was maybe one of the most soul, not crushing, but it just felt like there was a weight on my art. And I couldn't get out of this.
Oh, and W-E-I-G-H-T and a W-A-I-T.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. A literal weight. And then my husband and I moved to L.A. for a change, which was great. And when we got there, I got another waiting tables job. And I worked there for, I think, 3 weeks.
Where was it?
It was called Morell's. And it's still there. It's in the Grove. And I came home one day and he said, you just look so sad.
Aww.
And I said, you know, we moved here to do one thing and I can't possibly, you know, I can't. And he said, go quit. Quit right now. And I said, okay. And I never looked back. I never waited another table. I said, you know, I would sell books on Amazon. We would have monthly garage sales.
Well, so you still had to do other things.
Oh, certainly. But things that were empowering, things that I, you know, we had started the camp. Of course, we only had 25 kids, so it wasn't a real business at all.
Right.
But I went back out to getting more kids to come to the camp, to promoting.
What is the difference? I have a question, because I have noticed that there is so much talent in this world, in particular in music. Shocking how much there is. And there are people, I mean, I know people who are so good that you'd think they'd be collecting every Tony Award on Broadway.
Sure.
And they're singing in a restaurant in Santa Rosa, and what's the difference between people who make it to a certain level and people who don't?
It's a very...
Like what made you different than the people who came here to act and stayed in the restaurant service business?
I think when... You know, I can't speak for them because I didn't do it, and it's a noble profession, and I was just speaking...
Oh, everything is.
Oh, I was just speaking to a man who was driving the Uber that I was in last night.
Yeah.
And he was saying, how did you find your way to this independent career? How are you making a living at art? I'm struggling and I can't figure it out. And I said, you know, I can't put myself in your shoes, though I can ask you questions like, are you really staying out of your own way? When you say, all I'm doing is saving money, I'm trying to save up money so that I could take a year off and explore my art. Are you really saving up your money? Or are you kidding yourself? Are you going out Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night and blowing what you earn during the week and just saving enough to pay the rent? So ask yourself those questions. I said, I got very lucky with a couple of instances where I hadn't learned my life lessons yet. Yet opportunities still knocked.
And part is luck, yes.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was still able to answer the door.
Profession, I think waiting table, any kind of restaurant service where you make people feel welcome. You know, you said before, you started out by saying everybody wants to go to the party.
Yeah.
And making people feel welcome at any party at all is just so important.
Absolutely. So I think the key for artists is to know that if you wake up every day and your profession or your mission needs to be recognized by someone, then all you need to do, in the words of the great writer Steve Martin, is be undeniably good. Just be undeniably good. Stop worrying about how, when, who. You go out and do your work and someone will take notice of it. I'm hoping. I'm still doing it, you know, still going out every day. But I hear the same stuff when I do cabaret clubs in like Los Angeles, for example, where the entire industry is supposed to be. And I'll do a strong hour and 15 minute show and have the audience on their feet. And at the end, without fail, someone always comes up to me and says, why aren't you famous? Like, why don't you have a sitcom? I would watch you every week, which is such a huge compliment.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that you go, I'm not sure.
But you know, on the other hand, there are only 250 networks.
Exactly.
And there are only 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And there's more talent than that.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent out there. And maybe sometimes it's not about that end result. Maybe we all need to look at the fact that in the moment, even though I only had 60 people in the room, you know, it was a full club, but it's a small club. Maybe those 75 minutes with those 60 people exactly enough.
Yes.
Why can't that be it?
That's the best question of all.
That's success right there.
Okay. And so from there, I want to segue to love letters because you've said so many things and you know, that's what I talk about and it means a lot to me. That whole form of expressing the written expression of affection, any expression really, but that everybody wants to come to the party. Everyone wants to feel attractive. Everybody wants to be important.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is everyone is attractive and everyone is important. But it's nice if somebody sends a little reminder.
Yeah.
And isn't that enough, that being in the moment? Do you write letters?
All the time.
Okay, because my question is now, my usual, who, if you were to write a love letter right now, who's going to get it?
Oh, I have to say instantly, the obvious is my husband, right? I would say we write between 3 and 4 notes a week.
Oh, good.
To one another.
It's in handwriting.
Always handwritten. I have every single one of them. And what I'm planning, when will this air? Can I say it now?
Sure, say whatever you want.
Okay, he won't listen to this. I'll tell him not to listen until after.
Oh, because what you're planning.
It's so good. So for our, and it ties exactly into this. So I've saved every single love letter over the last 15 years. And one of my good friends, Dean Jones, who's this amazing wall upholsterer, like famous designer.
Oh, I can see.
We are turning all of the letters into wallpaper.
Oh.
And so it's custom. And so our entire bedroom will be wallpapered in the love letters. And
I just love it when I am made aware of something that I've never heard of before and would not in any universe have occurred to me.
Mm.
Oh, that is just wonderful.
I just thought, because the first idea for it was when we got legally married, because we've been married for 10 years, but we've been legally married for 8 years. And it occurred to me when we got married that we got over 500 emails of congratulations.
Yes.
Because people were so amazed that in San Francisco or in California that this had happened. And, you know, I thought, what am I going to do with these letters? What am I with these emails? How am I going?
So
am I
going to
create an art piece? I did. I have them all.
Good.
But then I started to think there needs to be a constant reminder of them. So yeah. So that's what I'm going to do for the 15 years. Create this wallpaper.
But you said you also have notes. So one is printed for email things,
mm-hmm.
and the other is notes. You're going to combine them?
Well, the emails are all from other people.
Right.
My husband and I have always been in our handwriting.
So that's going to go the...
That's going to be the wall, because it's very beautiful it lays out.
Handwriting rules.
And it's just two people's handwriting, and it's chronological.
When
from
you
the
get
first,
this down, will you take a picture and
I will, I will. I can't wait. Well, the issue is that we only rent in Los Angeles. So with the designer.
So will you put up a board?
We're going to have to figure out how to make it transferable.
Uh-huh,
I'm not going to
sure
do all the work.
Are,
and
no.
then, yeah, but it's going to be chronological.
So if you took plywood and made a false front.
False fronts, yeah.
Then you could do it and then just take it. Oh, good for you. I'm so glad you realized that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. Can you imagine?
No. I'm getting hives at the thought of,
yeah.
Leaving the mirror and have somebody else paint over them or something.
Tear it down. I mean, I guess you could always do it again, but.
But not with those notes.
No, but that'll be our biggest love letter so far, literally.
Oh, that's just perfect.
But I write all my birthday cards. My husband and I write probably, I think there's about 30 people a month on our list that we do our birthday cards to. And people still say all the time, I can't tell you how many people forget my birthday. And here we're doing, you know, 30 a month. And then every single time I get to see someone or have a lunch with someone or an engagement like this, thank you notes are... That's the thing my mother taught me.
Oh, so you do. Yeah, I do too.
Thank you notes are the biggest deal in the world, right. I think. And then once in a while...
And by the way, thank you notes really are a love letter.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Saying something...
Big time.
Something that you do made me feel this way.
Yes.
And that's really what the world's about, right. Like we said. So why are we hiding all that, you know, behind busyness or, you know...
I mean, my mother used to say, you know, it only takes 5 minutes to drop a note. Mm-hmm. You always have 5 minutes to drop a note.
And you know what amazes me is when people... And I'm not a technophobe. I just don't love technology. I love the convenience of it. I love being able to see, you know, people's vacation photos on Facebook.
Right.
But the thing that amazes me is it's supposed to have made communication simpler and easier for all of us. However, if you look at your Facebook wall mm-hmm. on your birthday, 90% of the people only write happy birthday. Mm-hmm. What? You're at a keyboard.
Yes.
All you have to do is say, happy birthday. Dear Janet, I cannot believe that it's already been this many years that we've known each other, and every day you bring light into my life. Thank you for being you, and any day that celebrates you is okay by me.
Oh, I'm so glad you are pointing this out.
How hard is that to type?
Well, because I do that sometimes, and as I'm doing it, I think they're going to cart me away because this isn't socially acceptable to go on and use Facebook as an actual piece of stationery.
Yeah, you're
but
just supposed
not?
To write, happy birthday, or a picture of a cake. It's just ridiculous to me.
I include those. But yes,
I like them too. Yeah. But then even when you say with the phone,
right.
You and I could make a video right now and it could be online within 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. But yet we don't take that 45 seconds to sing happy birthday and put that online.
So you're touching on something else. You're kind of saying that people don't realize the power they have.
Yeah.
It's and
just
maybe
become
that's
too
the
simple.
Difference between those of you who really achieve certain levels of accomplishment and some people who don't. Believing in your own power to do it.
I don't want to judge others because I don't know, but I do believe that social media has allowed us all to go to a more mediocre, simple level based on the fact that we see so much mediocrity. You know what I mean?
I sure
do. So many people are elevating and saying, like, look at this amazing quote. This is what I did today. I love when people say, I don't want to brag, but this is what happened. I'm like, Facebook should be a brag.
Yes.
We're putting pictures of our amazing vacations and our kids. And also it's a great place for people to reach out, you know, who may be having a hard time.
Oh, for sure.
I think it's great for that. But I just think that there's so much convenience in it.
So that's the word I was going to say. I talked to somebody a while ago and he referred to sending emails instead of thank you notes or mm-hmm. other kinds. Mm-hmm. And he referred to it as falling to the sin of convenience.
Yeah.
And there's something delicious about it. Convenience.
So a good friend of mine pointed out an older gentleman who's an Emmy award-winning director who kind of really helped start my career. Mm-hmm. We had an email exchange back and forth daily. And he finally said, do you realize that you're not even saying hello, you know, and then the person's name? You're not having any sort of even a one-liner of glad to hear that your dinner went well. Nothing. He said, you're just putting what you need in two sentences. Oh. Like in this case, he was editing something for me. So I would write back and say, you know, great edit. Try this and this. Hope to have it for tomorrow. And he said, and I know that you don't mean for it to come across as quick and inconsiderate, but it is.
Well, there's an issue here. And I think people tend to use email. Mm-hmm. People tend to think of email as a very fast way, a fast letter writing.
Yes.
I tend to think of it as a painfully slow phone call. You say what you want and then the other person. So you don't need all that, dear mm-hmm. sweetheart, I hope this finds you well, because you're just continuing a phone conversation.
Exactly.
So it depends
it's
how you look at
out.
It. Really. Yes.
Yeah, but we really do. When you sit down to write a letter, it's just that. It's just that one thing.
Right.
You're not looking for all the things that pop up on your screen.
You don't need the thread.
Oh,
I know. Oh, thank you for doing this with me.
Oh, it's so fun.
I can't wait. I can't wait to hear you sing. And I just want to say before I say goodbye, if you have other things to talk about and you want to share, come back and do another one.
Oh, I love it.
The sound of your voice is so nice.
Oh my God, thank you. And this morning voice for sure.
Good.
Kathleen
then we'll do it
Turner.
In the morning.
Yeah.
So if you think, I just want to say what I always say, if you think you have to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion, and now I see that it might be your collected wallpaper, or there's so many things to do with found letters or kept letters. Thank you, honey.
Absolutely, thank
well,
you.
Well, until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye.